Support for this public radio podcast comes from Acura, featuring the TL Type S with a 286-horsepower V6 and real-time traffic alerts. Learn more at Acura.com.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, sponsoring the James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards, with information online at www.irvine.org, and the California Endowment, working to ensure that Californians get statewide health reform this year. Online at cahealthreformnow.org.
From KQED Public Radio, this is the California Report. On today's show, after years of being nearly irrelevant, California's presidential primary stands to be decisive. After Iowa and New Hampshire, how are campaigns shifting gears to woo Golden State voters? And military recruitment. We'll talk with young enlistees about their decision to join the armed forces.
I never was in a gang, but I was around them, and they influenced me to do some things that I didn't want to do when I was younger. But now that's all behind me, and I'm ready to change my life and be a Marine.
Also, a visit to the longest-running theater for marionettes in Los Angeles.
One of those places, when you walk in the door, you go like, what decade am I in? So it's a form of time travel in a way.
I'm Scott Schaefer. Those stories plus a jazz review, Joni Mitchell meets Zhao Gilberto. It's the California Report. If there's ever been a more exciting and unpredictable U.S. presidential race, I don't know when. After Iowa and New Hampshire, who's a frontrunner? Hard to say. Enter California. We share our February 5th primary with 23 other states, but no other state has so many delegates at stake. In other words, this time around, California really is the big enchilada for both parties. Los Angeles Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz has our story.
We only have one candidate who's been out there doing the right thing, and Hillary is talking to New Hampshire voters.
As Hillary Clinton's victory in the New Hampshire primary was starting to solidify Tuesday evening, Clinton campaign volunteers at this small election gathering in West L.A. began to realize their work was taking on a new importance. With no clear frontrunner, California, by its sheer size, is suddenly a crucial state to win. Campaign volunteer Laura Strauss thinks her work will pay off for Clinton.
I think California is going to be her rising moment. I think California is going to clearly show her as the Democratic candidate, and I think that California is going to put an end to who's who.
Not surprisingly, the campaigns for every other leading candidate from both parties are giving California the same weight.
I can't overstate the importance of California to this election.
Republican Congressman David Dreyer of the San Gabriel Valley is co-chair of Rudy Giuliani's California campaign. Despite big losses in Iowa and New Hampshire, Dreyer thinks Giuliani's fiscal conservatism and his record as mayor of New York will help him in the Golden State.
He has been able to take Reagan conservatism into the laboratory of liberalism and work in a bipartisan way to make it a success.
All of this attention on California is making political scientists like Henry Brady at UC Berkeley simply giddy. For years, Brady has watched candidates sweep through using the state as an ATM. Getting them to stay and talk about the issues was like waiting for a solar eclipse. With the early primary, Californians now get to enjoy things the rest of the country has gotten used to. For example, when's the last time you saw a presidential campaign ad?
In general elections, we haven't seen those ads because everybody conceded the Democratic California to the Democratic Party. But now we're going to actually see some political ads, and that's going to be sort of fun.
Get that popcorn ready. Brady says your favorite programs will now be interrupted by waving flags with booming patriotic voiceovers as candidates try to address the issues important to Californians. Issues like the environment, immigration, and the war in Iraq. On the Democratic side, the differences between the two frontrunners on these issues may seem microscopic. In the end, Brady thinks Californians will opt for Clinton.
They liked Bill Clinton. They were happy in the 90s. It was a good decade for California. And so, therefore, to the extent that Clinton can play that card that we were the decade in the 90s, the Clinton administration opened up the economy, kept the economy open, and had tremendous growth, and it was really good for Silicon Valley, it seems to me that that's going to be a case that'll work for Californians.
But Stanford political scientist Shanto Iyengar says Californians are interested in more than nostalgia for the good old days. He says electability will play a big part, too.
If the Democrats are being strategic on February 5th, they are going to vote for someone that they believe will have the best chance of defeating the Republican come November.
And Obama, says Iyengar, is much more likely to attract swing voters than Clinton. Either way, the outcome on the Democratic side is hard to predict, says Iyengar, but not nearly as hard as the Republican side.
If the Democratic side is people playing checkers, the Republican side is people playing chess.
UC Berkeley's Brady says California's Republicans are hard to pin down. Some pundits say John McCain's vote for a bill that would have offered amnesty to illegal immigrants may ruin his chances here. Brady says the fiscal conservatives of Orange County are liable to vote for Romney or Giuliani. But the evangelical Christian voters in the Central Valley and the Inland Empire, where the real estate slump has been more strongly felt, may be attracted to Mike Huckabee.
They're going to love Huckabee, because here's a guy who's right on the social issues from their perspective and also talking about their economic needs, something the Republican Party has not done too much of in the past.
Californians will have many opportunities in the next few weeks to weigh their decisions, and if at the 11th hour they're still not sure, both parties will hold their final debates prior to the February 5th Super Tuesday primaries in Los Angeles. For the California Report, I'm Rob Schmitz in Los Angeles.
One issue that will confront the next president, whoever he or she is military readiness. The wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have left the armed forces stretched thin, putting more pressure on military recruiters. The Department of Defense reports that after missing its recruiting goals in 2005, the Army lowered its standards, allowing recruits with criminal records or low scores on aptitude tests to enlist anyway. Here in California, the National Guard is also struggling to attract and retain recruits. Membership in the Guard has been steadily dropping for more than a decade. Today, there are just over 20,000 members of the California Guard, down from 28,000 in 1990. That's a 27% drop. With those challenges in mind, recruiters continue visiting high schools and colleges in hopes of convincing young men and women that military service is a good option for them. On a Thursday morning at Santa Teresa High School in San Jose, Staff Sergeant Matthew Smith is meeting with students in grades 9 through 12.
Good morning. Wow, three of you here today. Last class was asleep. You guys are a little bit more riled up. My name's Staff Sergeant Smith.
Smith downed a Rockstar energy drink for breakfast, and he'll need it. Some of the kids here are just 16 years old, and on this morning, they're a little restless. It's a tough group to command, even for this 36-year-old veteran staff sergeant.
We're here to talk about the California Army National Guard and college opportunities for you, okay? How many of you here are going to or plan on going to college? Okay, awesome.
For the next hour or so, Smith describes the benefits of serving in the National Guard. He hands out a flyer with action photos of men dropping out of helicopters. As Smith talks, he tosses miniature footballs imprinted with the Guard's logo to students who ask or answer questions. The Iraq War hardly comes up until Smith shows a slideshow with photos from a recent tour of duty there. There are pictures of ordinary street scenes, Iraqi policemen, Iraqi women, who Smith says are much better off since the U.S. invasion. But the class really comes alive as slides of the recruiters and their weapons are projected onto the wall.
This is Staff Sergeant Hayes when he was in Iraq on a scout sniper team.
Yeah,
that was sick. What kind of gun is that sniper rifle?
Is that M21?
M21. What about that? Oh, man, that's huge.
Outside the classroom, I ask Master Sergeant Kurt Mager how the Iraq War is affecting the Guard's recruiting efforts.
You know, we usually find ourselves on the defensive of, you know, why we're there, what we're doing. And, you know, we try not to get into the political realm of that. You know, we have a job to do, and we do it.
California ranks dead last among the 50 states in per capita participation in the National Guard. And it can't help that in the past few years, more California National Guard members have been pressed into active duty in Iraq and Afghanistan, and at least 26 have died there. Mager acknowledges that in some parts of the state, especially the San Francisco Bay Area, recruiters are up against strong anti-war sentiments from students and their parents.
We're trying to fight the feeling and the attitude that, you know, all we care about is, you know, sending kids off to war. That's not true. You know, we're here to help and any way we can. And whether or not a kid joins or not, if we can give them information on college, give them information on scholarships, or point them in any direction, that's what we're trained to do.
Critics of the all-volunteer military say recruiters often prey on kids from low-income families, many of them minorities, who see military service as their best chance for getting out of poverty. Mager acknowledges that recruiters don't have the best reputation. In fact, a 2006 report on military recruitment by the Government Accountability Office found increasing accounts of wrongdoing, like withholding facts about enlisting and falsifying documents. That report did not include the National Guard, but Mager knows they too get tarnished anyway.
The old cliche, you know, recruiters lie and everything, we're really trying to change that. Again, when we talk to students, it doesn't benefit us by misleading them.
And yet the flyer handed out by the Guard recruiters is misleading. It promises 100% tuition assistance, a claim that comes with a big caveat. There is some federal tuition assistance available, but National Guard recruits have to apply for it, and the money always runs out. California is currently the only state with no college tuition assistance for Guard members in its general fund budget. This week, Governor Schwarzenegger proposed changing that, but the legislature rejected it last year. After spending time with these recruiters, I wanted to meet some actual enlistees. The U.S. Marine Corps invited me to attend a regional ceremony for the newest pool of recruits, or poolies, as they're called.
Yes, sir!
More than 100 young men and women from the San Francisco Bay Area turned out at the Mare Island Sports Arena in Vallejo recently. They came for a ceremony celebrating the Marines' 232nd birthday. For most of them, it's their first taste of life in the Marines. After a brief ceremony inside the sports complex, the enlistees participate in an intense but friendly competition.
Ready, begin.
Recruits from five different recruiting stations square off against each other in three events, starting with pull-ups. They face off two at a time as their new comrades shout encouragement. Many of these recruits look like kids, really. Few are a little pudgy, others kind of scrawny, with typical teenagers' posture. Not exactly the poised, starched, orderly Marines they hope to become. Over the din of shouting recruits, I spoke with several of them about the road ahead. Jonathan Johnson is a 25-year-old recruit from Daly City.
I didn't grow up in the best of the neighborhoods, so I kind of ran with the wrong people. I never was in a gang, but I was around them, and they influenced me to do some things that I didn't want to do when I was younger. But now that's all behind me, and I'm ready to change my life and be a Marine.
Johnson sees joining the Marines as part of a larger tradition going back generations.
My family is a long line of military. They served from every war, from World War II all the way to the present, except this last war, and I'm here to fill in that gap.
Family is a common topic among these young recruits, including 18-year-old Pablo Hernandez from Santa Rosa.
I have 9 brothers and sisters in total. I have 2 brothers, 6 sisters, and they all live here. You know, we're a really good family. We get together. We're supportive to each other, and that's what's really good about it.
Are you the first to join the U.S. military?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. How do you feel? How do they feel about that?
They're kind of scared, but they're behind me 100%, and I'm proud of that. Hopefully they're behind me to the thick and thin.
Like Hernandez, Raymond Marin from Vacaville has family roots south of the border.
My grandpa actually came across the border from Mexico from nothing and became a U.S. citizen. And that alone showed me a lot of determination and pride that he had, not only being an American, but the heritage that came with it that he brought to the United States. And I just wanted to be able to pass that along in the Marine Corps and just everything.
Marin assumes he'll be going to Iraq. When I ask if he has any concerns about getting hurt or killed, he offers a comment I heard repeatedly from these recruits.
No concerns if I do somehow come into harm's way. Whether the training that the Marines give you will save or be able to put me through the danger.
Sitting in the stands watching are Bob and Bambi Spencer from Richmond, California. Their daughter Hannah, a high school senior, came home from the mall one day and, out of the blue, announced she was joining the Marines.
I was just surprised. I went out of town and my husband called me and said, oh, your daughter joined the Marines. I go, oh. Well, yeah, I had a lot of questions.
Because Hannah is just 17 years old, she needed her parents' permission to join the Marines. And like most parents, the Spencers wanted answers to their questions, like how long was Hannah committed to the Marines and what happens if she changes her mind.
They came over to the house, the two recruiters, and they answered all our questions. And we were pleased with the answers, and that it was the best thing for Hannah at this time.
Hannah is likely to deploy in August, and the Spencers say they're happy for her. Her father thinks it will give her the structure she needs and an appreciation for teamwork. Recruiters say parents are the biggest obstacle to getting young people to enlist. Marine Sergeant Gregory Monroe says his recruiters approach it this way.
We just tell them just like it is. I mean, it's there. We can't hide it. We tell them, hey, your son got a chance to go. Hopefully he won't ever go. We don't want him to go, but you got to understand there's always that possibility.
Recruiting enough young people is only half the battle. The other half is retaining them when their time is up. This year, the Marines added a new $10,000 cash bonus to men and women who re-up for another 3 or 4 years.
Held high and told yourself we're true. Lost or changing as the days come down to you.
Bossa Nova swept out of Rio in the late 1950s and conquered the world with its harmonically sophisticated melodies and insinuating, stripped-down samba grooves. The form has become a staple for jazz musicians everywhere, but Sosa is looking to take Bossa Nova, which translates roughly as new thing, into fresh territory. With her gorgeous, crystalline voice, the Sao Paulo-raised Sosa has been a major force on the American jazz scene for more than a decade. The new Bossa Nova is her first album since relocating from New York City to Venice Beach in 2006. It's a savvy project featuring tunes by the likes of Leonard Cohen, Sting, and Randy Newman set to the intimate, flowing pulse that defines the Bossa Nova sound. Here's her quietly stricken version of Elliott Smith's haunted lullaby, Satellite.
'Cause the names you drop put ice in my veins. And for all you know, you're the only one who finds it strange.
Sosa is no stranger to ambitious concept albums. The three-time Grammy nominee has recorded a series of projects in which she set the poetry of Pablo Neruda and Elizabeth Bishop to music. The new Bossa Nova is a collaboration with her husband, veteran producer Larry Klein. Working with him, she displays some real songwriting chops on You and the Girl.
Did she tell you her secret? Could you tell when she'd cried? Did she laugh at your faint praise?
She's backed by a stellar band throughout the album, including Brazilian guitarist Romero Lubambo, Venezuelan pianist Ed Simon, and Mexican drummer Antonio Sanchez. My only quibble with the CD is that Sosa doesn't take more risks in her song choices. Instead of sticking to tunes by well-known pop composers, she could have slipped in a left-field choice or two. But then she wrings every last bit of pathos out of Brian Wilson's most abject love song, and I just want to start the album again from the beginning.
If you should ever leave me, though life would still go on, believe me, the world could show nothing to me. So what good would living do me? God only knows what I'd be without you.
Sosa closes the album with one of the most beloved Bossa Nova jewels, Jobim's Waters of March. Jazz singers often take the tune at a brisk canter, but Sosa slows it down, reveling in its kaleidoscopic survey of life's simple pleasures and pains. Sosa brings such grace and intelligence to the new Bossa Nova that I don't care much whether the songs are new or old. I just want to hear more.
The oak when it blooms, the fox in the brush, a knot in the wood, the song of a thrush, the wood of the wind, a cliff, a fall, a scratch, a lump, nothing at all. It's the wind blowing free. It's the end of the slope. It's a beam, it's a void. It's a hunch, it's a hope. And the riverbank talks of the waters of March. It's the end of the strain. It's the joy in your heart.
Andrew Gilbert is a San Francisco Bay Area writer who covers jazz and world music. He reviewed The New Bossa Nova by Luciana Souza. And finally today, the longest-running marionette theater in the country lies on the outskirts of downtown Los Angeles. It's run by 83-year-old Bob Baker, who's been a puppeteer for 75 years now. The Bob Baker Marionette Theater is still a popular destination for school kids, but over the years, it's become a little run down. Queena Kim brings us this postcard.
It's hard to imagine it now, but in the 1930s, there were dozens of puppet theaters here in Los Angeles. There was no TV, and you might go to a movie once a week. But to fill in the time in between, people would go see puppeteers like Bob Baker. Would you mind showing me how puppets move?
This is the main part of the control, which holds his head. We have a string here that picks up his cane, and then he taps.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the Bob Baker Marionette Theater! All right.
You have to want to feel what you're doing. You want to be able to feel that you're dancing. You want to feel that you're acting. And you just can't pretend you're wiggling a string. That doesn't do it. You're a cat tap dancing in a number.
You have to inhabit the puppet.
You got it. You inhabit the puppet.
Said, I want for you guys to sit back, relax, have a great time as we present Bob Baker's Marionette Show.
I drove by for 15 years and never went in here. I was imagining like little lamb chop sock puppets or whatever, and I thought, you know, don't know if I need to see that. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is Charles Phoenix speaking to you.
Pop culture historian Charles Phoenix.
Then finally I'm like, no, I've got to go in there. So I came into the theater and I couldn't believe what I saw.
The hat I got for Christmas is too big. It's nice, but my sombrero is too big. Is it raining? Is it snowing? I can't see where I am going. Cause the hat I got for Christmas is too big.
It's one of those places when you walk in the door, you go like, what decade am I in? So it's a form of time travel in a way.
Oh my goodness. This is like a huge room filled with tapes and records.
See, each show has its own 78 or a 33, or I can use the newer CDs. We didn't have sophisticated sound in those days. We had a big speaker, and we said it was high fidelity. It was just louder than the others. And I remember we used to, early day, we put on the recording of Jealousy, have it up loud, and you hear those violins, hear those strings. I was interested in show business even as a very young boy. I was taking dancing and tap dancing and Russian dancing and piano and acting all at the same time, but I never could get the kids in the neighborhood together to put on a show, so I was able to build my puppets and do a show. Bullocks Wilshire called me when I was 8, sent me out to a home in Beverly Hills, and I did a puppet show for them for a birthday party, and it was the height of depression. They paid me a whole $15 for the show, and that was more than some people got all week. And I went back to Bullocks Wilshire. I said, send me out on as many shows as you want to. I'm ready to go. I worked in 2 nightclubs, but I had to go in and out the back door because I was underage.
How old were you?
I was between the ages of about 14, 15.
Do you remember one of the puppet scenes that you did at the bar that was adult, but maybe not too adult so that we can air it on the radio?
Don't worry, it's quite suitable for the children. This is a story about passion, bloodshed, desire, and death.
One of the things we did, well, they were smoking hashish.
I'm sorry, so the puppets were smoking hashish?
Yeah, but they were smoking this stuff and supposedly having these wild dreams.
What were some of the wild dreams?
Well, they had dancing girls, and they did a little nudist thing, and, oh, they kind of a love scenario.
Come in, Polly,
they would pick names of people who are in the audience. Then they would call these names out and use them as the characters, you know.
Do you see puppetry going on, or is it an old form of entertainment that's going to start fading away?
It will never fade away. It'll come in various forms, different forms. It will go on, because man always liked to create in his image.
For the California Report, I'm Queen Akim in Los Angeles. When you're lonely on a rainy night, stop by for coffee and a little
bite. And that's our show for today. The California Report is a production of KQED Public Radio. Susie Rocho is our chief puppeteer and director. Howard Gelman is at the board today, and we had additional engineering from Danny Bringer and Tom Krimkowski. Our online editor is Gabriel Cohen. Our interns are June Stinson and Ali Tabatabai. The producer is Victoria Maleon. Ingrid Becker is the senior producer. Bruce Kuhn is the news director. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the Wesley Foundation for coverage of immigration issues throughout California, and the California Healthcare Foundation and Cal Hospital Compare, a new website rating hospital quality in California at calhospitalcompare.org.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.